Okay, hi, Jorge.
Hi, good afternoon.
Great. Welcome to the show. It's great to have you on here.
Thank you for inviting me for this interview.
Great. So, just to kick off, why don't we just start by speaking a bit about yourself and what you do and your background. So, how did you end up becoming a scientist? How did you?
Sure. So I think when I was a kid, I wanted to be essentially rich. I wanted to work in banking. And then something went wrong, and I decided that I wanted to be a crazy scientist instead. So that was a fairly easy step for me to take because science was the easiest subject for me. It just means that you need to understand the equations, and maths was just another language that would allow you to express these laws of nature. So essentially, I studied physics, and after that, I wanted to continue doing research. And I considered industry, I considered doing a PhD, and ended up doing a PhD in a research institute. So it was fairly applied. And after that, I already had gathered enough momentum, so I moved on to do a fellowship and then a postdoc, and then I became a lecturer, and now I'm here.
And why exactly did you choose to specialize in quantum technologies? And more specifically, why in integrated photonics and cryogenics?
So quantum technologies was not really a thing when I was a student. When I started, I was interested in quantum physics, and this is something that I still find many students that consider completely separately. And that's essentially because my training as an undergrad was in physics. So quantum mechanics and quantum physics in general is quite a large field on its own. And adding the technologies term only makes it a bit more let's say practical. And this is something that has happened in the last 10 years. And it's weird because quantum technologies in itself is a concept that is a bit misleading. Quantum has been in technology for many years, starting with the transistor. Well, not necessarily starting, but that's probably one of the highlights of quantum technologies. But what has changed and why the reason that quantum technologies are so relevant nowadays is because quantum information can be applied for practical uses as a technology. And that is something new. That is a novelty. And the reason I joined quantum technologies was because actually I was interested in photonics. And I figured out, oh, wait a second, there's a group in Bristol that is doing some quantum information using photonics. So it's quantum physics, which is cool, and photonics, which is something I'm comfortable with. And it was just it was really impressive to come here and see the vision, the goal, and all the effort that was being put into this area. Now, integrated photonics was rather my interest for, I would say, since I finished my degree, because I like light. I like the ability to manipulate light, and particularly using technology to build devices that can be manipulate light, create and detect light. That was very exciting, because light is probably one of the simplest particles you can get out there, and as a physicist, that's always interesting. It simplifies your models and your equations, and then you can take care of other things. Now, cryogenics, which is the newest part of my skills, let's say, came as a necessity. I was not that familiar with cryogenics before joining Bristol. Actually, some of the work I did in my PhD, I sort of actively avoided cryogenics. There were some reasonably good results by some competitors that were using cryogenics back in the day. I was working on quantum dots. And I will always avoid the cryogenics because I said it's not practical. You will never manage to have something that is useful for the general public if it needs cryogenics. But then I joined Bristol and I realized, wait a second, we don't really need every individual to have a quantum computer in their pocket. And the main effort at Bristol at the time was quantum computing. Now, the reason we need cryogenics is that pretty much all the technologies that require quantum information want to isolate your system, your qubits, from the environment. And the environment, amongst other things, brings temperature and heat, and that adds randomness and decoheres your states. That does not necessarily apply to photonics, but photonics need to also to have very good detectors. And the detectors that were good enough for quantum information applications and were, you know, realistically feasible for large-scale integration for silicon photonics in particular were based on superconducting nanowires. And therefore, we needed part of the experiment to be at cryogenic temperature. So essentially, I joined Bristol and I was told, look, we need to solve this problem. And the problem is that we need loads of single photon detectors. And the best detectors so far are these, you know, nanowires. So let's try and figure out a way to realize that. And that's how I started working on cryogenics.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, that's interesting. Maybe we'll come back and talk a bit more about cryogenics in a minute. But could you, now that we're talking a bit more about your work, could you give us maybe an overview of the projects that you're currently working on and which ones you think are most interesting or most important and why?
Sure. So probably I can concentrate on the work I'm doing at Bristol. And it started, as I said, as a problem, which is how to integrate as many detectors as possible to enable complex photonic circuits. One of the first things we realized is that in order to have scalable quantum photonic devices that have any possibility to have any active feedback, you should integrate your detectors with the rest of the photonic circuit. And that meant that the modulators, the photonic modulators in your integrated circuit had to work at the same temperature as the detectors. And the single photon sources that you would use would have to work ideally on the same platform. I mean, potentially you can extract those single photon sources and keep them in a separate environment. But the issue there is that injecting light into integrated photonic circuit typically induces some loss. The chances of you having perfect match between your modes is very, very low. What that ends up meaning is that you will lose efficiency in the photons you generate. So in any quantum photonic system, especially if you're using it for quantum information processing, you need three elements. You need a source, you need something, a circuit to generate and manipulate your states, and you need a detector to actually project that state and see what the outcome is. So my current effort, as an overview, is trying to put these three things together and making sure that they work within the context of all the trade-offs that you need to make. And this is if the detectors, the best detectors that you can use require low temperatures, everything else has to work at low temperatures. If your modulators are going to generate heat, how are you going to dissipate that heat from the rest of the circuit? And if your sources require a particular material, how is that material going to combine with the rest of the circuit? So it's a fairly multidisciplinary approach that is targeting scalability as a primary goal. It's not that much how the individual components perform, but rather what's the best way to combine existing technologies to develop something that is practical.
Okay, great. Now that we're talking about silicon photonics, do you think that silicon photonics is a promising platform for quantum computing over more, I guess, commercially established platforms like superconducting qubits?
This is a tricky question. So there's definitely amazing results out there in other platforms that are not based on photonics. But all these approaches have so far one big challenge on the horizon, and that is scalability. Superconducting qubits have a physical size, and that limits the size of the processor, and that limits you know, how many connections you can have in it, and forces you to ultimately consider distributed computing systems, which are not unthinkable, just a different engineering challenge. Trapped ions are also really promising and have a similar issue. Your ions have to be trapped in some physical space, and that requires your computer to be large. And there's certainly blueprints that that hint at the possibility of building such a large system. Is just very technically challenging. But we have CERN, we have other big scientific projects that require lots of technology to be implemented, and those have been successful. So there is no reason why, you know, we should not expect that to happen at some point. Now, photonics has a different advantage. Photonics devices are based on qubits that are encoded in time and space, but don't really have such a large requirement for space. The issue with photonics is that the technology that we use currently to build these circuits is not yet good enough to produce the very low loss that will enable us to have a scalable approach. That said, most of the research in photonics is happening with technology that is typically about a decade older than what is available for the traditional electronics market. So there is a hope that if a large enough investment is made, silicon photonics will actually break that barrier and will enable a much more scalable result in a much shorter term than these other technological platforms. So ultimately, the issue with all these platforms is, what is the financial investment? These are all facing now technological challenges rather than conceptual physical challenges. So in this context, silicon photonics is one of the photonics platforms. Silicon in itself is an excellent material for some applications, not necessarily for all of them. And it has some intrinsic challenges that need to be overcome to make it practical for quantum applications. Now, these are currently rather fundamental. So fundamental based on the material properties. So new concepts need to be brought in. So at the moment, I would say that silicon photonics is not the best platform or not the most promising one, but photonics on its own, as a more generic approach, still has many advantages over other competing platforms, despite the fact that the results on the other platforms is already there.
Thanks. That's interesting. So could you tell us a bit more about some of the alternatives? So you mentioned that silicon photonics in itself might not be the best platform, but photonics more generally might be. So could you mention a bit about possible alternatives? So are you thinking that different materials, for example, might be more promising?
Yes, correct. So silicon has the advantage that it has the backing of the electronics industry, because it's the same material platform that has been used for electronics, and therefore all the equipment, all the processes that we developed for decades can be directly applied. Now, silicon is also good for photonics because it has a transparency window, and that means that light goes through it very easily at wavelengths which are compatible with the telecommunications industry. And that is a very good matching, because then you can use all the technology developed for that for that area of the industry. So these are two very large, sources of resources that we can use to push the research without having to deal with the technology in the short term. Silicon has further advantages, and that is that photonic components are fairly readily available, because photonics in itself has applications in communications, in LiDAR, even in sensors. Now, the challenge here is that because we're using a wavelength that is not visible, the best detectors that we need to use are superconducting. That pushes all the advantages down and actually is a big, big challenge. So the question is there any alternative? And, you know, you can consider trying to use a different material with a different wavelength that would enable you to use detectors that are not superconducting, although those detectors are not necessarily that good yet. You can try and envisage a detector that doesn't require low temperatures, but that still is not on the table. Still very early research for that field. So it looks like superconducting components are going to be required regardless. So in that framework, silicon loses some of its advantages, in particular modulators, but you can combine silicon as a core material with other elements that are compatible. They're not necessarily the CMOS standard, as we call it, but they're compatible with that technology. For instance, you can use electro-optic materials combined with silicon to have fast modulators. You can have dielectrics like silicon oxide or silicon nitride or silicon oxynitride, which essentially enable you to use much shorter wavelengths and at the same time reduce the nonlinear effects that may actually affect your quantum states that are being transmitted, that may scatter or absorb your single photons and therefore make you lose some of the efficiency, overall efficiency of your system. So exploring different materials and exploring different wavelengths is certainly on the table, whilst trying to keep low temperatures appears to be at the moment a big requirement. So there's other challenges that come with that. But yes, in terms of alternative platforms, I would say that there's other materials. People may think as well there's been a large effort, especially from the telecommunications industry, in developing 3-5 materials, so other semiconductor compounds that are good at some applications and maybe with some investment are going to be also fairly useful for quantum technologies. But those would require a much larger investment in terms of material development, which is currently happening in some areas. So there is still hope that we may discover a material combination that is convenient enough to manufacture and at the same time has these excellent qualities that we need for processing and generating single photons.
Okay, thanks, Jorge. So when do you think it's realistic to expect commercial applications for near-term quantum computing on an optical platform? And what do you think it'll be most useful for?
Ooh, complicated question. Commercial applications. So there's an interesting, I'm obviously not working in any startup or involved in any industrial prospect that is dealing with commercialization of these technologies. So it's all the guess of someone working in academia. But there's a fine line for me between what is something that is commercially viable now and something that may have an impact and may have an advantage in the long term. So I would say the short term, it's unlikely that we'll be, and when I say short term, I mean next 5 years, it's unlikely that computers based on, you know, quantum photonics will make an impact that will be significant. However, I think longer term, if certain developments in the technology are in place, these things can happen. So what is the first application? I would say that the easiest and most direct application of quantum photonics would be in simulating simple and medium molecules. So simulating quantum systems with a quantum system. And there's been quite a lot of effort already from the private sector, not always being publicized the same way we do in academia, but there's certainly some effort and I would expect the first results to come from that area.
If you don't mind, I'd like to ask you a bit more about your work in cryogenics. So you've already mentioned a bit about why you think it's important, because as you mentioned, our current best single photon detectors need to work at cryogenic temperatures. But what are the main challenges to running an optical quantum computer, say, or just trying to do silicon photonics at cryogenic temperatures as compared to room temperatures?
So the first challenge is the detection. But besides that, I would say that there's some implications of what happens. How do the material properties change when you go to low temperatures? And that's just material physics. And the interesting thing, or at least one of the reasons, one of my motivations to explore that area, is that people traditionally haven't cared that much. It's not something that has been explored in detail. And there's certainly new science to be learned, studying what happens to matter when you reduce the free energy it has, which is essentially reducing the temperature. Now, how much do you want to reduce the temperature? And that is the thing. In order to get superconducting single photon detectors, typically you need to go to temperatures of just a few Kelvin, 1 or 2 Kelvin, which is still much higher than the temperatures required for other platforms like superconducting qubits. But it is a temperature that is lower than probably the easiest to achieve low temperature, which is that of liquid nitrogen, or a bit harder, liquid helium. So liquid cryogens are fairly straightforward, I would say, to employ in a lab, but they have several challenges other than the safety of working with something at extremely low temperatures. You also have the challenge of sustainability, and that is that both of those elements will essentially leave the Earth once released. So essentially, we're consuming a resource that will not be there in the future. So it's very important to find ways to sustainably generate low temperatures at that range. So there are systems that allow you to do that, and there's been quite a lot of support from industry, not for quantum technologies, but rather for medical imaging. And we can benefit from that. We can benefit from those low temperature systems to generate an environment where our detectors can work. So now the work in superconducting single photon detectors can be split essentially in two areas. First, originally what was called the bolometers or transition edge sensors, which were based on measuring the amount of energy delivered by a single photon as a change in the properties of the material. That's a very, very efficient process that has quite a few advantages, but has to work at even lower temperatures. Now, the more recent advance, and that's the reason that my work at Bristol started, where it started, is that you can find configurations based on nanowires, which are very, very small sections of superconducting material that change dramatically their properties when illuminated. And that also depends on the material type. So if a new superconducting material is developed, there's potential for it to be used for these applications. However, there's intrinsic limitations of the material in itself. So there's lots of material science behind it. Now, the challenge is if you want to use one of those detectors, you have to make sure that the temperature is stable, so the properties are consistent and you can predict them. In order to do that, you have to make sure that there's no reason for the system to raise the temperature. However, with any complex system, especially if you connect that system to the environment, such as a cable to the outside world, well, you're going to be able to, you know, communicate with your system. That is going to bring external energy in the form of heat. That heat is going to raise the local temperature, and therefore your detector will stop working efficiently. So you need to have a fairly efficient way to extract all that additional energy from your system, and therefore your cryogenic environment, your cryostat, has to grow in size and complexity. Obviously, there's very efficient and large systems out there, but in the case of a lab environment, it's rare that we can get anywhere, you know, close to a percent of power efficiency. So these are very inefficient systems that generate lots of or consume lots of energy to bring the temperature down. And that is a challenge for long-term sustainability. But again, there's not necessarily an indication that we'll need to have many of these cryogenic systems working in parallel. And potentially these could be miniaturized and made more efficient. I mean, there's certainly work in, for instance, having very, very small cryostats put into satellites, keeping the temperature very low. So, and that is definitely work that is going on at some institutions. But now for the application of quantum technologies, my challenge is, if I want to have many detectors, you know, able to detect single photons independently, those will have to be connected to some sort of electronic circuitry, and that will bring additional temperature increase. So I have to make sure that the electronic circuitry is both fast enough to process all this information and low power, or, you know, low power compared to the system capacity to extract power, so that my detectors will not be overwhelmed and I won't need a cryostat that is 10 times larger. So ultimately, what I've been dabbling with in the past few years is also trying to devise strategies to combine electronics with photonics and try to bring the efficiency of the whole system as high as possible and minimize power dissipation, whilst keeping to the limitations of quantum technologies in itself.
So I'd like to talk a little bit about now the quantum engineering CDT at Bristol and your role as the director of the CDT. So could you tell us a little bit about what the CDT is and how it fits into the bigger picture of emerging quantum technologies?
Sure. The Quantum Engineering CDT is a postgraduate training program sponsored by the Engineering and Physical Research Research Sciences Council. So it's a nationally sponsored program, one of two within the UK, the other being at UCL, and currently is, we started at the eighth year, the eighth cohort, which means we've been 8 years around. It was conceived quite a while ago as a way to capitalize these critical mass that we have at Bristol of expertise and skills and resources. The idea of the CET is that we offer postgraduate training, particularly PhD projects to students that we recruit from a fairly large pool recently. And we do that by offering a first year of training modules that include traditional lectures and some practical modules or units for every student to figure out what is the project that they enjoy the best. And essentially we treat this year as a training and trial period for everyone to make sure that they're happy with their choice. And following that, they have 3 years to do their research with pretty much anyone that they want to consider. We've been fairly successful, as in every year we've been getting more and more applications, and students graduate, and we typically have a very good feedback from everyone about their time at the CET. So the other question you asked me about was what is the role of the CET in quantum technologies? Well, as I said, this was established 8 years ago. There were pretty much no training programs that specialized in quantum technologies back then. If you wanted to do a PhD in quantum, you probably had to find a supervisor that was interested in the field that had some ongoing projects. And then you would join them and maybe find halfway through that you enjoyed that a lot and that was your career path, or otherwise you may have been very disappointed that the technological platform was not ideal for you. So one of the things that we try actively in the CET is to offer a very broad overview of all the approaches that are out there. We offer training in the theory aspect, so what is the approach for development of new theorems, algorithms, the fundamentals of quantum information, and also practical involving quantum photonics. But we also give access to concepts in superconducting qubits, trapped ions, and other platforms because we know that for us, it sounds, at least at Bristol, fairly clear that photonics is the way to go. But there are other approaches that may sound more convincing to someone. So it's ultimately the choice of the students, what they want to do with their PhDs. And that is something I think it's fairly different from other programs. And we also try to cater to, let's say, a broader range of skills in the first year. It's not only research. We try to promote other activities, lots of team building, lots of networking, some, you know, software development, for instance, or organizing activities, which is something you normally would not find in a traditional PhD. And I think that that sets us apart from other PhDs and hopefully allows our graduates to have a much easier career in whatever they choose after they finish their PhDs.
Thanks. And you mentioned that the CDT has been running for quite a while now, for about 8 years or so. Do you see, do you envisage any changes coming on the horizon? Are you, or is it going to run on as before?
That question does not depend on me, as this is a sponsored centre, and therefore it depends on whether the UK research institutions are happy to sponsor this area further. There is certainly, in my perspective, a massive skill gap in quantum technologies at the moment. There's lots of demand with lots of new startups that are employing you know, engineers and quantum physicists and people with expertise in cryptography. And academia is also trying to employ the very same profile. So we have currently a clash, and that is worldwide, not only in the UK, but many other countries. So I would say that there's definitely the capacity to benefit from people with that set of skills. And at the same time, as I said before, we have had every year more applicants, which means that there's the demand. So from my point of view, there's definitely the appetite for more quantum engineers to be trained at PhD level. My understanding is that obviously if this is something that is going to have an impact on industry and the private sector, there is the expectation at some point that the private sector will support some of these PhDs. Although that means that ultimately students will stop having that choice of what they want to do their research on. So we'll lose some of the flavor eventually that made the CDT what it is, and which is the freedom to explore specific projects, even if they're not necessarily that popular. So ultimately, my hope is that we can reach a balance and have a blended solution. Blended is a word that we're using lately very much, where we have industrially sponsored PhD projects, and we also have some free flow exploratory options for academics that are not necessarily following the mainstream of quantum technologies and that bring some novelty and some disruptive approaches to the field.
Okay, and what is your role specifically as the director of the CDT involve? And do you find balancing your responsibilities as director with research and other responsibilities difficult, or how is it?
Well, I have to say that I'm a bit biased because I've been in this role for not very long, just a couple of years. And in this time has essentially coincided with two big things. One is obviously the pandemic that has affected everyone worldwide and that has forced us to adapt and change some of the ways we have to deliver our program. But also the fact that a few of the academics that were part of the core staff have moved on to other positions. And that has meant that we have had to rebuild the whole team and recruit new academics to teach quantum. So in that sense, I think we've been a bit overrun and trying to adapt to a very different way of teaching and delivering. But once that is done, and compared to what the CET director would do otherwise, I think there's essentially four main tasks that the director needs to address first is make sure that the ultimate goal, the vision of the CD, is kept and it's defended, because ultimately that's the reason we got sponsored, and that's the reason that we're allowed to train these excited cohort of students every year. So keeping the vision and the direction, and making sure that we adapt to the situations while offering what we promised that we would offer within reason is the main task. I would say that the next one is being able to adapt the program to the current needs. And as you can imagine, in a field like ours, in 8 years, there's things that have changed quite dramatically. So we've had to adapt the program. We've had to include some new concepts and probably stop teaching some other things that were not as useful as before. We tried to do that through some very dynamic units with lots of guest lecturers that brings the expertise of research at the teaching level, even at postgraduate, but it enables us to be a bit more flexible than other programs would be. The next one is essentially having that presence with industry and enabling students to have a career or pursue a research PhD within industry. So having that network active and bringing in as many partners as possible that can make a positive contribution to the career of the CET students is probably the next point that I would consider critical. And finally, a bit of matching what the strategic interests are for the UK research community in quantum technologies, try to keep up with what the national programs are and how those match with what we're teaching, and manage expectations of the students of what are the possibilities during the PhDs and afterwards. And managing the expectations of potential supervisors on what sort of skills the students would have during this period. So this is four different aspects of what the director of the CET involves. There's also the obvious politics and management and admin workload that comes us with a role like that. But ultimately, the key directions are those.
So, and you mentioned at the start that originally you wanted to be a banker and make lots of money before switching to be a scientist. I was wondering if you might give any advice to young people who are maybe thinking in a similar way, maybe the young bankers who want to switch to science, or just people with skills in STEM who want to work in quantum technologies. What advice do you have for people like that?
I would say that ultimately anyone that pursues science as a career has a rather romantic view of what the field is. We do this because we really like the idea of what it means rather than necessarily what the daily activities actually entail. It's those little moments where you manage to discover a new concept, understand a phenomenon, or work as a team to achieve something that is novel. It's those moments that keep you going. And therefore, it's not necessarily the most practical approach. There's more practical solutions elsewhere. So I would say that back in the days when I started my career, it was mostly driven by that sort of enthusiasm, blind faith that this would be amazing. Nowadays, there's so many opportunities, both in academia and outside academia, that pretty much anyone can join in, even if you're not that enthusiastic. If you have the skills, there's definitely opportunities for you to contribute to this field and develop some new technologies, some new algorithms, some new ideas, some new IP, or even help. What's the word I'm looking for? Help convey to general public, do some outreach, general public communication, explain to the rest of the world what is it that we do here. It doesn't sound, you know, it sounds fairly straightforward, but actually it's very challenging because this is cutting edge science and there's many concepts that are not out there yet, or at least not everyone is aware. So there's a big span of skills that can be used in this field, and still you can manage to work. If particularly, I would say right now there's a big interest in bringing engineers, traditional engineers, in the field of quantum, because there's challenges that, you know, someone like me with a physics background doesn't necessarily know how to address immediately. There's interest for, you know, people with a computer science background or people that understand quantum chemistry. There's, you know, it's not limited anymore to the crazy scientist that wants to have a lab coat and, you know, have some laughter with some lightning behind. I would say that if I have to offer some advice on how to pursue this career, why to pursue this career, I would say first try it. Try reading about it. If it sounds interesting, try, you know, consulting some interviews, see what the experts say, talk to your local scientist. And if that still sounds interesting, maybe consider having a short placement, spend a couple of months working on it, consider a short project. And after that, if it's still interesting, well, maybe it is for you. Maybe you should do it. Maybe you should try it. But also, if your skills are completely different and you're just curious, try and figure out whether there's something that hasn't been done in the field that you can contribute to. So there's many ways of addressing or joining this field, regardless of your background. I think it's a growing field and it will need or it will welcome pretty much anyone.
Okay, thanks, Jorge. And what do you think the biggest challenges are for the field of quantum computing and quantum technologies over the next 10 years? And how optimistic are you about the chances of overcoming these challenges?
Let's see. The biggest challenge, there's a few challenges. There's technical challenges, there's societal challenges, there's financial challenges. So one challenge that I would start with is the ethics of having quantum computers. So quantum computers are potentially allowed to or have the capacity to break down some of our security measures. So it's a risk for society, for the ways we've been doing things so far. But it's a risk that can be managed. There are solutions that we can implement that will go around some of these promises that quantum computing can offer that are harmful. Now, quantum computing also promises to have applications in other fields. These have not yet been realized, at least not that publicly. So I would say that quantum computing in particular needs to have a very well-defined killer app in the next few years to keep the investment, to keep the hope that it's going to be as disruptive as it looks, appears to be. Now, quantum technologies are much wider, and I think there's already potential applications that will be implemented in the next 4 or 5 years. As I said, you know, quantum simulators is one of them, but you can have quantum enhanced sensors in the very short term having an impact. And quantum communications will definitely bring a new approach to some of these strategies. There's been quite a lot of effort into, for instance, satellite-based quantum communications. So that's a field that I think it would be fairly quick adoption, even if it's not, even if it doesn't perform as well as traditional communication strategies. I think there's lots of potential for the platform to be implemented soon and let grow by the user base. So essentially be financially viable regardless of external investors. Now, there's technological challenges. Obviously, as I said, there's a limit on the scalability of the current approaches, and this is something that has to be faced by pretty much all the platforms. So how is that going to be sorted out is not yet clear, but it looks like it's mostly a technological problem. So I think with enough investment, it will be sorted out. So I would be surprised if within 10 years we don't have working quantum computers in several places worldwide. So maybe you can say that I am optimistic. The other challenge that we may have is based on the distribution of or the access to this technology, which is currently restricted to, you know, not that many countries. And that means that some countries will have yet more advantage in dealing with certain problems, which will create further inequality, which is not great. And we have to think ways to, or at least as a scientist, I think we should assume part of the responsibility of contributing to that increase in inequality and think of ways that we can sort it out, or at least prevent it being too bad. And finally, the last challenge for me is based on human resources and how many people can work on a topic. And this is a completely new field and it's growing a lot. And I think we need even more people. So we either will have to retrain a fair fraction of, you know, the technologically skilled people out there, or we'll have to train new generations. But I'm not sure we can train fast enough. I think this is a big challenge, especially now where academia and the private sector are competing to recruit the same profile of expertise. Is essentially leading to the fact that we may run out of experts in academia to train more experts to go out elsewhere. And this is, I would say, a challenge in the short term that may slow down the progress of the field.
Thanks for that. So just before we finish, we're now coming to the end of the interview, but we've spoken a bit about your research so far and how you got here, your career up to now, but what are your plans for the future? Do you know what your projects that you plan to work on over the next 5 years, say, and where next for your career? Are you have you got plans for where you'd like to go next?
Well, I am optimistic about the Quantum Engineering City at Bristol. I'm optimistic about the research at Bristol. I think the critical mass we have here of both expertise and infrastructure is really impressive. And, you know, the talent that we have around in startups will help us grow further. So I would say that some of my future plans is secure further collaboration with all these ecosystem of startups that we have around. Now, more specifically, what I'm interested in doing is dealing with that interface between electronics, photonics, and low temperatures, and trying to find, you know, better solutions for the needs of quantum information processors. Whether it's on, you know, quantum communications or quantum computing, that's to me is not as critical as the fact that being able to offer a platform that can deal with the critical requirements, particularly of photonics and the encoding of qubits on photons. But other than that, I would say that Bristol is one of the best places you can be for quantum technologies.